Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight we bring you an excerpt from the annual Boston-Melbourne-Oxford Conversazioni on Culture and Society, held last fall at Boston University. The theme was Responsibility and Historical Inevitability. Participants included the university professors, members from La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, and Lincoln College, Oxford, among others. Tonight's presenter is historian and social commentator Keith Windschuttle, author of The Killing of History, How Literary Critics and Social Theorists Are Murdering Our Past. Mr. Windschuttle speaks on Utopian Dreaming, Grand Theory and the Historical Impact of the Radical Intellectual. Mr. Windschuttle.
In 1985, Cambridge University Press published a book called The Return of Grand Theory in the Human Sciences. It was a collection of essays edited by Quentin Skinner designed to celebrate an iconoclastic group of theories about human society. Several of these theories were not new, the editor noted. Some, like those of Marx, Nietzsche, and their derivatives, had their origins in the 19th century. But by the 1950s and 60s, he said, they had been rejected by prevailing academic opinion in most English-speaking countries and consigned to the dustbin of history. However, in the 1970s and 80s, new theorists breathed life into them once more, and they emerged to restructure the humanities and social sciences. Although in 1985, Skinner wrote at the time, they had not yet toppled the main enemy, which he defined as piecemeal empirical research, they were nonetheless well on the way. And let me quote, I'll give you a long quote of what Skinner said. During the past generation, utopian social philosophies have once again been practiced as well as preached. Marxism has revived and flourished in an almost bewildering array of forms. Psychoanalysis has gained a new theoretical orientation with the work of Lacan and his followers. Habermas and other members of the Frankfurt School have continued to reflect on the parallels between the theories of Marx and Freud. The women's movement has added a whole range of previously neglected insights and arguments. And amidst all this turmoil, the empiricist and positivist citadels of English-speaking social philosophy have been threatened and undermined by successive waves of hermeneuticists, structuralists, post-empiricists, deconstructionists, and other invading hordes. Unquote. Now, this passage by Skinner was particularly prophetic. Most of the intellectual movements he identified have since been extraordinarily successful, while the English empiricism that he so derided has become increasingly unfashionable. In academia today, to publicly declare yourself an empiricist is to provoke many knowing winks and nudges. The grand theory of Skinner's title would have been more accurately labelled continental philosophy, because the book is mostly about the ideas of the German philosophers Nietzsche, Heidegger and Gadamer and their post-war French revivalists Derrida, Lacan and Foucault. It is a book about the so-called linguistic turn in the humanities, which has had such an impact on the English-speaking academic world in the past two decades. But the return of grand theory, it must be admitted, is a great title in terms of book marketing, because the Western intellectual class has long nurtured a deep-seated desire for grand theory. Over the past 200 years, Western intellectual life has become increasingly secular. But because human beings, deep down, are religious animals, the decline of traditional religion amongst the intellectual class has been compensated by a growing demand among that same class for grand theory. Although they are secular, most grand theories share two characteristics with religion, especially Christianity. They are determinist and they are teleological. This is why they are invariably theories of history. They claim that there are great forces that are moving society in a certain direction, from the past to the future and towards a certain end. And in most cases, the end is the perfect society, utopia. Moreover, there are no individuals who have the ability to change this direction. The Caesars and Napoleons of the world, or the Winston Churchills, are puny figures before the forces of history. The people who have ostensible power in society, the presidents and the generals, succeed only if they go with a historical flow. Now, this is an especially attractive belief for intellectuals because it elevates their kind above all others. The great figure of any age is the one who writes its grand theory, that is, the person who can best interpret the direction in which history is moving. And this person has the eternal appeal and celebrity of the prophet. As long as there is a demand for prophecy, we will have grand theorists and radical intellectuals. Now, much of this is familiar territory to anyone with a knowledge of the two most notorious grand theorists of the modern era, Hegel and Marx. The collapse of the Soviet Union, of course, totally discredited the worldview of Marxism. However, we have by no means seen the last of grand theory. And today I want to illustrate this by examining two more recent contenders for this title. Both of them have had a widespread influence on how we conceive the discipline of history. And after I finish with those two, I'll then look at a third historian who, in my view, demolishes everything they stand for. The first historian to offer a widely accepted alternative grand theory to Marxism was the French Nietzschean theorist Michel Foucault. In the 1960s, the movements of students and anti-Vietnam War activists promoted a great revival of Marxist ideas within the universities. However, some of the other radicals who emerged at the same time found the central tenets of Marxism difficult to follow. In particular, movements of radical feminists, homosexuals, prisoner activists, ex-psychiatric patients, and other so-called marginalised minorities were not impressed by the Marxist concept that the leading role in history was to be played by the industrial working class. Radical feminists saw the working class as a phenomenon defined by male theorists. In Foucault, they found in a more androgynous theory. Gay liberationists found Foucault was not only one of their own, but that he had a theoretical approach that rejected universal norms, including those which defined heterosexuality as the social ideal. To political activists inside prisons and other institutions who could see little point in joining political parties or trade unions, Foucault said that local struggles, not universal programs, such as socialist revolution, were the real stuff of resistance. Foucault's approach, moreover, was peculiarly suited to the university environment. It held that the main revolutionary struggle was not against political or economic institutions. He presented the notion that the true radicals were those who challenged the major Western philosophies, or what he called systems of thought. And this was a radicalism perfectly suited to practice in the academic realm of tutorials, conferences, cafes and bars. None of this, Foucault argued, was a less practical or inferior variety of politics. Theory, Foucault declared, does not express, translate, or serve to apply practice. It is practice. In 1966, Foucault had attracted a great deal of academic attention by coining the phrase, the death of man. And his obvious allusion to Nietzsche's well-known proclamation of the death of God drew a considerable notoriety to himself and to the then burgeoning school of anti-humanism. By the death of man, Foucault meant two things. First, the end of the humanist concept of man as a creature ruled by reason and will. And second, the end of the notion that history was a phenomenon governed by the decisions of powerful individuals. Instead, he claimed, history was a process without a subject. Not only did men not make their own history, but the concept of man itself, he argued, was passé. Now, Foucault shared this thesis with other anti-humanist thinkers of the time, including the Analyse school of French historians, all of whom regarded history as being driven by forces far more powerful than those of any individual. Anti-humanism's main proposition was that the autonomy of the individual subject was an illusion. The humanist tradition had been wrong to assign the central role of human affairs to the conscious mind and to free will. Instead, some varieties of anti-humanism claimed that human behaviour and thought were dominated by the unconscious, and hence humanists should abandon their assumption that purposive behaviour was consciously directed. Others, like the Analyse school, held that the impersonal forces of geography and demography governed the destiny of mankind. At the same time, Foucault believed the historian could not avoid the role of the political activist. All knowledge exuded power, he insisted, so the knowledge produced by the historian must serve political ends of one kind or another. Most historians, he claimed, were traditionalists who supported the established regime. However, he also identified what he called the new historian, someone who could help foster an insurrection of subjugated knowledges. In the 1970s, Foucault claimed this insurrection was being led by outcast groups struggling against authority, especially psychiatric patients and prisoners. At the time he proclaimed these ideas, Foucault himself was engaged in the radical prison activist movement, attending meetings and offering advice. He argued that the local knowledges of groups, such as prisoners, were crude responses to their immediate situation. They lacked any historical knowledge of predecessors who might have emulated their deeds. So their demands needed to be supplemented by the interpretations of a sympathetic academic like himself, a person he defined as the specific intellectual. And his job was to unite his, what he called his erudite historical knowledges with the disqualified knowledges of the outcasts. And this union would then produce subjugated knowledge, or a historical knowledge of struggles, that was formidable enough to challenge the power of those human sciences which sided with authority. Foucault's version of this partisan history, however, involves a self-contradiction. The notion that history is a process without a subject is in direct conflict with the role he prescribes for the new historian, to foster an insurrection of the subjugated knowledges of outcast groups in their struggle against authority. But by calling for the emergence of the specific intellectual to advise these groups, Foucault is appealing to a conscious subject who can act on his own free will. And the same is true as of those he defines as the oppressed. People will not automatically resist unless their conscious mind gives them some reason to believe there might be some point in it. And they simply cannot resist unless they have the will to do so. So Foucault's politics, then, are in direct conflict with his philosophy of history. And this is, in fact, a familiar dilemma that has faced previous generations of historians who also wanted to be political partisans. They were invariably historical determinists, who believed history was moving towards some goal and that the intervention of individual human subjects was largely irrelevant. Marxism is the best known of the theories hung on the horns of this dilemma. Marx was a revolutionary political activist who claimed the proletarian revolution was built into the course of human history. But if revolution is historically inevitable, there is little point in being a revolutionary yourself, because it will all come about without any individual agency. Nonetheless, just like Marx, Foucault predicted that human history was on the verge of entering its next stage. Foucault divides history into what he calls epistemes, or ages. And he says the three epistemes in the recent past were the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, and the Modern Age. He doesn't discuss the next stage, or the coming stage, in any detail, and so denies us a vision of the postmodernist equivalent of communist utopia. He says this future age can only be seen now as, quote, a light on the horizon. To achieve the next episteme, Foucault rejects most of the familiar concepts of Western radical politics. He rejects the notion of political revolution based on the large-scale transformation of society following the overthrow of the central state. The basis of power, he argues, come not from the centre, but from the capillary levels of the political body. From these outer levels, it flows to the larger centralised structures, just as the blood flows from the capillaries to the central organs of the human body. Hence, without changes to the outer local sources of power, changes made at the centre will be ineffectual. And this version of postmodern politics holds that because power is decentralised and plural, so too must be the forms of political struggle. There is one area, however, where Foucault demonstrably fails to break with the Western revolutionary tradition. Every grand scheme to transform society that has ever been dreamed up by an intellectual or an academic has always given a major role to the figure of the intellectual or academic himself. Foucault does reject the idea of what he calls the universal intellectual, who claims to represent or speak on behalf of the oppressed masses in order to institute a new world order. Instead, he substitutes the idea of the specific intellectual who advises the locals to help them with their immediate struggle. However, the essential role of the intellectual is different in nominal terms only. In Marxist theory, the proletarian masses need the universal intellectual to inform them of their historic mission and to help them realise it. In Foucault's version of politics, more specific groups identify their own immediate issues but still cannot define their historic significance nor conduct an effective resistance without the intervention of the intellectual. So despite his support for a less centralised politics, Foucault's postmodern intellectual still wants to be the centre of attention, just like all the radical intellectuals who've gone before him. Now, I've started today with Foucault because, as I said, I believe him to be the most influential radical historical theorist since Marx. One of his central concepts is that all intellectual fields are politically motivated. He argues that a site where power is enforced is also a site where knowledge is generated. And conversely, a site from which knowledge is derived is a place where power is exercised. In his book, Discipline and Punish, he wants to show the prison as an example of just such a site of power, and a place from which knowledge, essential to the modern social sciences, was formed. And reciprocally, the ideas from which the social sciences were formulated were the ones that also gave birth to the prison. So instead of referring to power and knowledge separately, he preferred the compound term power knowledge. And this concept is also central to the second intellectual I want to discuss today, Edward Said. Although Said is a literary critic, he has had a major impact on the study of history. The recent prodigious reference work, Companion to Historiography, edited by Michael Bentley, devotes an entire chapter to the work of Said. And no other single author receives such an extensive treatment. He gets as much space as the entire corpus of ancient Greek history. And this is a measure not only of his influence on the contemporary historiography of the relations between Western and Eastern cultures, but also of the degree to which the discipline of history has been penetrated in recent decades by the methods and interests of literary critics, who've been, in some cases, like in some fields such as cultural history, have become its leading lights. And much of this is due to the example set by Said in his celebrated 1978 book, Orientalism, in which he charged the academic discipline of Oriental studies with being the handmaiden of Western imperialism. And it's now almost impossible to study the relations between Western and other cultures in the imperial era without paying at least some attention to Said. In his book Orientalism, Said makes two major points. The first is that although it purported to be an objective, disinterested and rather esoteric field, Oriental studies functioned to serve political ends. The field was complicit in imperialism by providing the information on which European conquest of the Orient was based. Said is quite clear about the causal sequence. I quote him, "Colonial rule was justified in advance by Orientalism rather than after the fact," unquote. Said's second major argument, is that Orientalism has produced a false description of the Arabs and Islamic culture. This arose primarily because of the essentialist nature of the enterprise. That is, the belief it was possible to define the essential qualities of Arab peoples and Islamic culture in terms of the founding principles of their religion. These qualities were seen in uniformly negative terms, he says. The Orient was defined as a place isolated from the mainstream of human progress in the science, arts and commerce. Hence, quote, its sensuality, its tendency to despotism, its aberrant mentality, its habit of inaccuracy, its backwardness. However, these two claims are quite incompatible. If the picture of the Orient produced by Oriental studies is false, then it's difficult to see how it could have been the source of the knowledge that led to European imperial domination of the region. According to Said, Oriental essentialism is not knowledge, but a series of beliefs that are both distorted and out of date. Surely, though, if these beliefs are wrong, they would have contributed to poor judgments, bad estimates, and mistaken policies on the part of the imperialists. And hence the political power of Western imperialism must have been gained despite them, not because of them. Said's supporters, however, are largely unconcerned about such inconsistencies. On campus, he has now generated a considerable following in the tendency known as post-colonialism. This is an intellectual movement focused primarily on the study of history and literature, although it's usually conducted at such an arcane level of theory that many former students of either history or literature would find their subjects largely unrecognisable. Postcolonial social theorists and critics have gained a major foothold in academic life in the United States in departments of both history and literature. The aim of their project is to use postmodernist and post-structuralist literary analysis to deconstruct historical documents to recover the voice of the colonial oppressed, and in turn to suppress the voice of those who colonised them. Dipesh Chakrabarty, a post-colonial historian, actually came to US via Australia and is recently employed to the University of Chicago. He's written a book called Provincialising Europe, whose title neatly summarises the intellectual ambitions of the movement. Chakrabarty says, provincialising means, quote, to read the European philosophers of modernity in order to show up the parochialism of their imagination, unquote. The post-colonialists want to subvert the logic of history as a field that produces knowledge. In general, if a category or concept is used by Western historians, this identifies it as part of Western or Enlightenment discourse, and so the post-colonialists insist on rejecting it. In using postmodernism and post-structuralism, they are adopting theoretical tools used by other currently fashionable political movements on campus. And let me quote from the journal Postcolonial Studies, which describes their political alliances and connections. I'll quote it. Postcolonialism has much in common with other related critical endeavours, such as women's studies and gay-lesbian studies, classified under the rubric of the new humanities. Marked by an underlying scepticism, these closely aligned projects find their shared intellectual vocation in a determined opposition to coercive knowledge systems and, concomitantly, in a committed pursuit and recovery of those ways of knowing which have been occluded, or in Foucault's terminology, subjugated, by the epistemic accidents of history. Given its particular inheritance, post-colonialism has directed its own critical antagonism towards the universalising knowledge claims of Western civilisation, unquote. But I should note the Western civilisation, that quotation is actually itself in scare quotes, indicating they don't really believe it's a civilisation at all. So, in other words, although it claims to eschew Western culture, the methodology of the post-colonial critique derives from one radical stream of the West itself. The members of this movement want to reject the West, but all they are doing is rejecting one aspect of its intellectual culture, empirical historiography, while accepting another, post-structuralist theory. The point of all this theory, it's important to recognise, is to apply it to politics. In 1993, when Edward Said's most ambitious book, Culture and Imperialism, was published, Ernest Gellner wrote a scathing critique in Time's Literary Supplement that promoted an acrimonious debate between him and Said. Gellner asked, "What is the point of denouncing Western culture and imperialism when your political position does not warrant it?" Said's multiculturalist politics, he said, were little more than a mild form of internationalism and endorsed a world where the different races and cultures should be nice to one another. Now, it's true there are places where Said does endorse these kinds of values. But what characterises his book, and indeed all of his work, is a kind of doublespeak, where he says one thing at one place and something quite different about the same subject at another place. Had Gellner read Culture and Imperialism a little more closely, he would have found Said recommending the politics of the French colonial author Frantz Fanon and his book The Wretched of the Earth, which became the single most influential manual in the 20th century about how to conduct anti-imperialist warfare and revolution. It's one of the sacred texts of the post-colonial movement. Fanon's book was the source of inspiration for Pol Pot's drive in 1975 to empty Phnom Penh and to murder the middle classes and other supposed collaborators with the former French colonists. And Said actually endorses the same program. He says that after a colonial revolution, wherever it might occur, the capital of the country should be deconsecrated and demystified. Now, deconsecrated is the term that Fanon used to advocate abandoning the capital after the colonial revolution and taking the government to the countryside among the rural masses, which is exactly what Pol Pot did. Said is aware of all this. He says that there is an understandable tendency to see in Fanon's writing a blueprint for the Pol Pot regime, and he then goes on to attack all those on the political right who make this connection. But he makes no attempt to dissociate himself from these views at all. And the violence that Said supports in the Third World is matched by the violence of his followers at home. Although the movement that organised the recent anti-globalisation riots in Seattle, Washington and Genoa is composed of a young generation of student-age radicals, much of its thinking is a replica of its elders like Said and his anti-American alter ego Noam Chomsky. In fact, if you look at www.nologo.org, the website of the Canadian journalist and unofficial spokeswoman of this movement, Naomi Klein, The first interview published after the September 11 terrorist attack was with Chomsky himself, who pushed the now familiar line that America had got what it deserved. And SAID's articles are frequently either published or linked on the No Logo site as well. Naomi Klein also wrote an article for the American weekly The Nation in which she responded to charges that the terrorism of September 11th was part of a continuum of anti-American violence started by her own adherents. But rather than being intimidated by such charges, she wrote, the anti-globalists saw the terrorist attacks as an opportunity to promote their movement. And by early October, they'd announced a campaign of economic disruption against the conservative provincial government of Ontario, which involved an attempt to shut down the financial district of Toronto. At the same time, they were organising another mass campaign to disrupt the next meetings of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank and the World Trade Organization. Now, if you've seen the television news coverage of the anti-globalisation riots, you can tell from the appearance of the demonstrators, you know, tattered singlets, tattoos, body piercings, that they are your typical upper-middle-class university students. They're not a renter crowd who are likely to be discouraged easily. And in a number of ways, they share common characteristics with the terrorists who struck on September the 11th. Both groups have similar origins and motivations. While one is secular and the other religious, the sociological background of both the anti-globalisation activists and the jihadists are parallel. Both are movements of the well-educated and the wealthy who claim to speak on behalf of the wretched of the earth. Both kinds of activists are opposed to what they claim is US-style materialism and profiteering. And both have the crippling of US power and that of its supposed subsidiaries like the World Trade Organization and the World Bank as a fundamental goal. While the violence of the anti-globalists has been nowhere near as audacious or murderous as those of the jihadists, theirs is a difference of scale rather than kind. And they're here for the political long haul, just like the protesters against the Vietnam War in the 60s. And this is because their motivation is sustained intellectually by a substantial body of historical theory. As I've argued here, this corpus derives from principles established by Foucault and furthered by Edward Said. It's internally incoherent, indeed it's self-contradictory, but that has not prevented similar movements in the past from gaining wide support, and it's unlikely to do so this time either. It's a political movement that has all the intellectual accoutrement needed to attract young intellectuals, an epistemological foundation, a theory of history, a cultural critique, an economic analysis, and a political agenda. It also has a postmodern political methodology derived straight from Foucault's idea of power originating in those capillary levels of the political body, from where, via organisations connected by the internet and cell phones, it hopes to eventually overcome the larger centralised structures. It's very unlikely, of course, that the anti-globalists will achieve any of their political aims in the foreseeable future. They do not have the makings of any kind of large-scale popular movement. Their appeal is likely to be limited to the university campus and to people of the same age and intellectual persuasion as themselves. For the most part, they are consigned to the politics of frustration. Convinced of the virtue of their cause, but obsessed by the wickedness of the social system that refuses to implement it. And like previous versions of themselves, the Russian and German romantic revolutionaries of the 19th century and the radical factions of the American, Italian and German New Left of the 1960s, the ultimate recourse of their political position is to the propaganda of the deed, terrorism and assassination, just like their Islamic counterparts. Now, because this is another movement based on a grand theory of history, one effective way to confront it might be at the level of its grand theory. If this is so, then one of the most effective weapons will be, in my view, that humble activity so derided by Quentin Skinner of piecemeal empirical research. Empiricism differs from grand theory in the respect it gives to historical evidence. While it's true that historians often come to their task with the aim of pushing a certain line, of establishing a certain point, or of solving a certain problem, one of the most common experiences is that the evidence they find leads them to modify their original approach. When they go looking for evidence, they do not find simply the thing they're looking for, but most will find many others they had not anticipated. And the result, more often than not, is that this unexpected evidence will suggest alternative arguments, interpretations and conclusions, and even different problems to pursue. In other words, the evidence often makes historians change their minds, quite contrary to the practice of theorists, whose aim is primarily to find evidence that fits their already established preconceptions. For the theorist, if the evidence poses a problem for the theory, it is the evidence itself that has to be rejected or explained away. The Decline and Fall contains some of the earliest versions of what later became the specializations of social history in his analysis of the character of the barbarian tribes of Germany and Siberia, of economic history in his discussion of the trade between Rome and China, and of religious history in the social dimensions of Roman paganism, of Christianity and Islam, plus the institutional and theological development of the church. However, in the realm of Gibbon's political history, it remains true that crimes, follies and misfortunes dominate the scene for long periods of time. One of the reasons why Gibbon remains such a good read today is the pace of his story as he narrates the careers of those who ascended to the emperor's purple robe from what were sometimes very humble origins as common soldiers and peasants, and in some cases even a couple of slaves made it. But equality of opportunity in Rome was matched by equality of outcome. Rome was plagued for most of its existence by the problem of succession, which was normally accomplished by a civil or military rebellion combined with the assassination of the incumbent emperor. Gibbon's analysis of all this is sophisticated enough to recognise that a large-scale political system, such as the Roman Empire, can itself display relative stability while at the same time suffering continuous turbulence at the level of the palace. The body stays intact while the fight goes on in the head. In the histories of great monarchies, he says, the attention of both the writer and the reader of history is naturally drawn to the court, the capital and the army, while the millions of obedient subjects pursue their lives in obscurity. In less established systems, such as the early republics of Athens and Sparta, he says the impact of ordinary individuals is much more influential and thus attracts more historical attention. In other words, in opposition to the French Enlightenment's search for general laws of historical causation, Gibbon argues that the scale of explanations needs to be appropriate to their subject. In some historical circumstances, such as newly formed or emerging polities, the role of individuals such as founding fathers may be profound, an observation that's certainly true of the history of the United States. In other circumstances, a social system may be so well entrenched that it can survive the worst kind of abuse from apparently powerful political figures. Similarly, once major internal systemic problems have emerged, neither the fortunes nor adversities of politics may be able to stem the tide. For instance, under Justinian, the general Belisarius recaptured Italy from the Goths and recaptured Africa from the Vandals. But the economic decline of Rome, coupled with high taxes and the complete loss of martial spirit among the citizens, meant that new armies could not be raised, and so the territorial gains could not be held. Under the reign of Justinian, Rome had reached a state of economic and political weakness where, Gibbon says, and I'll quote him, even if all the barbarian conquerors had been annihilated in the same hour, their total destruction would not have restored the empire of the West. Gibbon also argues for the impact upon history of the role of chance and the influence of unintended consequences. The outcomes of the wars between the various German tribes who contested the territories on the periphery of the empire, Gibbon demonstrates, depended as much on luck and ignorance of the enemy's position as it did on strength of arms and valour. The eventual survival of the Franks in Gaul was due to such accidents and fortune, while the complete extermination of the Gepidae nation was a result of an alliance formed between the Lombard and the Avar kings that was directed more at Rome than at the hapless Gepidae. Gibbon's great work turned him into a London literary celebrity, and he was one of the most popular authors of his day. His writing was both an expression and a reflection of enlightened opinion in the late 18th century England. Even though he's widely regarded as a figure of the European Enlightenment, we should recognise the great difference between the sceptical Enlightenment of England and Scotland on the one hand and the radical Enlightenment of France on the other. For instance, while the French philosophers saw their king as the barrier to freedom, Gibbon regarded a hereditary monarchy as a precondition for a civilised political system, since it solved the problem of arbitrary succession that had caused so much bloodshed in Rome. His attitudes to the savages and barbarians of Siberia and Africa was also the opposite of his French contemporaries. In a long passage, he dissects and demolishes Montesquieu's concept of the noble savage, the idea that natural man is virtuous, but it is civilization that makes him corrupt. For Gibbon, this romantic idea is the opposite of the truth, as he demonstrates through several extensive examinations of the bleak and lawless pastoral societies of the Goths, Vandals, Huns, Tatars, Mongols, and other nomads of the plains of Siberia and the Ukraine, who periodically fought their way across the Danube to wreak havoc on the cultivated lands of the Mediterranean. In short, the intellectual product and legacy of the English sceptical Enlightenment is quite different to that of the French radical Enlightenment. In Gibbon, the spirit of inquiry and the fruits of research confirmed the values of the existing institutions of English society. In France, these tools were deployed in opposition to the same institutions. In England, Gibbon emphasised the responsibility of individuals and celebrated the virtue and courage of statesmen and churchmen, even though he recorded that the natural passions of humanity were likely to leave such qualities in short supply. In France, the philosophes sought to find general laws of society that would render the actions of individuals irrelevant. The intellectual heritage of the English Enlightenment, as exemplified in Gibbon, clearly goes some of the way to explaining the different political histories of the two countries in the ensuing two centuries. Since the 18th century, England has enjoyed a stable national history marked by a gradual extension of its democracy, while France has been periodically racked by revolution, internal collapse, and foreign invasion. In other words, in the course of history, ideas about history itself are independent variables. They can contribute sometimes in small part, but sometimes in large part, to historical outcomes. In the modern era, the track record of the empiricism of English historiography is largely positive, while that of its rival, the utopianism of continental grand theory, is almost entirely negative. It's time for the supporters of empiricism to come out and make the virtues of their methodology and the vices of its main opponent far better known. Thank you for your attention.
Author and historian Keith Windschuttle. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. You're listening to an excerpt from the annual Boston-Melbourne-Oxford Conversazione on Culture and Society, held last fall at Boston University. We just heard from Keith Windschuttle, whose lecture was entitled Utopian Dreaming, Grand Theory and the Historical Impact of the Radical Intellectual. Now, reacting to Mr. Windschuttle's assertions, is Richard Pipes, Professor Emeritus of History from Harvard University. Professor Pipes.
I have been asked to react to this paper almost last minute, and I knew nothing of what Professor Windschuttle is going to say. I've read his books, or at least his book on killing history, and let me just say to begin with that I totally agree with him, both his critique of those who assail empirical history and empirical historiography, and his concluding remarks that we should stand up for the English tradition of empirical historiography and challenge the theorists, the grand theorists of history. As a rational historian, I'm particularly aware of the tremendous damage done by grand theorists of history. In my History of the Russian Revolution, I pretty much blame Russian intellectuals for what happened in 1917 and afterwards. What I wish to say is make a few remarks on the central theme of this conference, which is historical inevitability versus role of individuals. Let me say that as a practicing historian, I have a certain skepticism of philosophy of history. I feel a bit like Joshua Reynolds, who I remember once reading, complained about theorists of art who spoke about pigments and about brushes, but never actually painted. When I work on historical materials, on primary sources, on memoirs, and so on, I am really not troubled with the question whether what happened was inevitable or was not inevitable. I just deal with the sources. They sing to me. They speak to me. I rework them in my imagination and write down what I see. Foucault, Fanon, Said, and even Marx and Hegel have absolutely no influence on me. Maybe I'm unusual in this respect, but I don't see any relevance of philosophy of history and the work of a practicing historian. Now, when we come to the question of the conflict between the idea of historical inevitability and the notion that history is made by great men, I have a feeling that the dispute rests to some extent on a misunderstanding, that people who hold one position and the other position are talking past each other. The phenomenon of inevitability, or I would say high probability rather than inevitability, applies to phenomena which to the historian appear as processes, long-term processes. The human factor plays a decisive role in what one may call events. Now, processes, historical processes, are phenomena of longue durée, where a certain momentum is generated, which makes the results more or less outside of human volition. Let me give you one or two examples. Let's take the secularization of the Western world, which has occurred since the Middle Ages. It began sometime in the Renaissance period, accelerated in the 18th century. I don't see that individual human will has anything to do with it. The process went on its own for various reasons which are very profound. There were individuals in the 18th century, philosophers and so on, who accelerated it. But the process would have gone on even without it, the theory provided by the philosophers of Enlightenment. Another process is the dramatic growth of world population since the middle of the 18th century, which has profound effects on every aspect of human life. Here, human evolution is irrelevant. And a third example would be globalization, which we see today. Here, too, the will of individuals is irrelevant. Globalization proceeds on its own, not because certain capitalists get together at the World Economic Forum in Davos or elsewhere and decide they're going to globalize the world economy. It's just in the works by itself. Then you have events which are historical phenomena that take place in a very limited time and place and are usually determined by individuals. Contrary to Leo Tolstoy, the War of 1812 was decided by Napoleon, by nobody else. The outcome of it was to some extent the result of certain processes which were outside of Napoleon's will, but nevertheless, the war itself would not have happened if Napoleon hadn't gotten bored with the life of somebody who had all of Europe at his feet. President Bush's declaration of war against terrorism, I think, is decidedly the result of the will of one man. I think if President Clinton were in office, we would not have seen that. The subject which I know the best, which is the Russian Revolution. The Russian Revolution, that is, if by that you mean the process of the gradual collapse of the Tsarist government from the middle of the 19th century, I think that was more or less inevitable because of its ineptitude and because of its detachment from the population at large, particularly the educated classes. But the events of October 1917 were absolutely not inevitable. In fact, they were extremely improbable. If Lenin had fallen out of the train that was carrying him across Germany, they would not have taken place because he and he alone pressed his Bolshevik followers to seize power. And we have testimony of no lesser an authority on the subject than Leon Trotsky, who says that if he and Lenin were not in Petrograd in October 1917, there would have been no Bolshevik revolution. Of course, that was not the theory of the Bolsheviks. They spoke about the masses pushing them to make the revolution. But in fact, we know in great detail what happened hour by hour in October 1917, and it was Lenin's fanatical drive to seize power that decided the issue. So in other words, I think this is, to some extent, this debate is to some extent what the Germans call a Scheinproblem, a non-existent problem, because there are inevitabilities, or I would say high probabilities, of long-term processes happening in a certain way, unstoppable by human will, and there are events which are determined by human will where inevitability plays no role at all because it can go this way or can go that way. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. You're listening to excerpts from the Boston, Melbourne, Oxford Conversazione, and as the name implies, it is a conversation, typified by questions and statements from a participating audience. Here now are some of those questions, with responses from author and historian Keith Windschuttle.
In the 1970s, when I was a student in England, I remember a debate on the pages of the TLS between Christopher Hill and Jack Hexter about lumpers versus splitters. And Hexter said that on the left, one tended to have people who were lumpers, who were putting together grand theories as opposed to doing research, as opposed to the splitters who were making fine discriminations. If I might say so, I would think Mr. Windschuttle's paper suggests that one can also have lumpers on the more conservative part of the political and ideological spectrum.
What really concerns me are the Natalie Zeman Davises of the world, because there's a sort of fast track now to academic eminence and to getting jobs in universities. If you're a graduate student, the smart strategy is to pick up a particular issue. You don't have to do much research into it. You simply look at the leading books on the topic. You deconstruct them. You analyse their politics. You make reverent citations of the prevailing guru in the field, such as Edward Said, and then you sit back and wait for Said to recommend your academic appointment, to lavish praise upon you. And that's the inside running in academic debate is going that way, whereas empirical work, which means you have to steep yourself in all the secondary sources in a field, then define a topic that no one else has done and a problem that's meaningful, and then go down and get your hands dirty in the archives, is slow, laborious, and unfashionable. And as I see it, the people who are getting the jobs in history departments, the rising generation, are the people who play with words and play with theories rather than the ones who do real hard empirical research.
Well, I don't want to take up too much time. Let us comment very briefly. Empiricism is a theory. I think it would be a great pity to have theory or philosophy seen to be the creature of the left or the preserve of the left. Historically, thankfully, that is not true. I think that as what you're saying about how people get fast-track jobs in academia, it is true that in certain fields of literary theory, what you say may have a particular merit. But I can tell you firsthand that students of Natalie Zeman Davis, and I don't stand before you as a great admirer or defender of hers, are people who are very well trained, usually, in the mysteries of the French archives. They may take problems that I personally would not see as fundamental, and they may take positions that I find unfortunate. But to say that these people don't do empirical or archival research is just not true.
Okay. If I could just make one short comment on the distinction between theory and empiricism. By no means anything I'm saying should be interpreted as being against large-scale generalisations. Large-scale generalisations are fine as long as they are backed by historical evidence. The distinction I'm making is between people who will put their theories and everything else has to follow the theory. The theory is prior to the evidence. Real historians, the process of scholarship is to rely upon this outside thing called evidence, which has an objectivity of its own, no matter what the postmodernists tell us that it's kind of all contaminated by ideology. It's that, in my view, is not true. Evidence first equals empiricism, but that also contains large-scale generalisations, which some people do mistake as theories, but if they are dependent upon the evidence, they are really empirical generalisations.
Yeah, I mean, just add that, I mean, if you have a theory, you can do archival research and find just the kind of evidence you need to support your theory. Or you can look at the evidence and you start with a hypothesis and you change the hypothesis if the evidence indicates that it was wrong.
Well, I would like to ask Mr. Windschuttle to engage in a brief foray into sociology of knowledge. You indicate that the ideas, the ideologies of Foucault and Said have become so fashionable in the academic community in the United States and indeed in the Western world, and I agree with you. But my question to you is, how do you account for that? Ideas do not operate in a vacuum, and ideologies do not operate in a vacuum. They have to be institutionalized. To get a set of ideas accepted as the going concern of a profession, you have to obtain control of professional organizations, you have to obtain control, editorial control of journals, you have to dominate the hiring committees of departments, etc. And I'm asking you if you would speculate as to how this process occurred in the course of the last 15, 20 years. It wasn't that these two individuals and their ideas just sort of emerged spontaneously, but presumably a large number of people thought that they were correct and then, as you would perhaps put it, insinuated themselves into the appropriate institutions and turn those ideas into important social facts, as the sociologists would call them.
Yeah. Well, in terms of the sociology of knowledge, there's no kind of social demand or social need for these ideas. But at the level of the intellectual class, as I tried to open my remarks with, there is a kind of need for something to compensate for the death of God. In a secular society. And grand theory performs that kind of sociological function among a thin class of intellectuals. How it became entrenched in the academy, and that's still whether how entrenched they are is really an open question. In the universities I know in Australia, the humanities and science are totally captured by these people, and having worked with them and having done a bit of this myself, the first tactic is to first get hold of the appointments committee, get a majority on the appointments committee, and then you appoint people who think like yourself. Secondly, you do a lot of book reviews and you praise your friends and you make friends with the book reviewing editors of journals, etc. You set up a mutual admiration society. If that doesn't work, you start your own journals, and the plethora of journals that have been started with peer reviews, and of course peer is really the operative word because they are people who all agree with each other, and you can create an academic industry that is self-perpetuating. And it fulfills the strategy which the new left of the 60s made quite clear, the long march through the institutions. Some of them, the European Parliament's now got some of the new leftists from the 60s, and we've got a High Court judge in Australia who's a new leftist from the 60s who seemed to be a perfectly respectable guy, but the minute he became got in the High Court and unsackable, suddenly he turned into a different sort of person. There are a lot of people like the people who are communists in the 30s, who nobody knew about until the 50s when they were found to be involved in espionage, not fundamentally different to the new left of the 60s, who have captured a major sort of control of some academic institutions. And it hasn't been done with any kind of party organisation. It's been done by a form of mutual understanding, this is what we do.
You've been listening to a lecture by author and historian Keith Windschottel and reaction from Harvard University Professor Emeritus Richard Pipes. From last fall's Boston-Melbourne-Oxford Conversazioni on Responsibility and Historical Inevitability. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was...